Hello. Today, actually, Linux Voice issue 4 goes on sale in the UK. And it's got a cover feature about Ubuntu and its respins, and I don't think it's all that negative, which is good, because we're here at Nick Veitch's house. There's no Andrew Gregory, which is why I'm doing the introduction, but we make up for that with Nick Veitch, and I'm Graham Morrison, and this is the Linux Voice podcast. Who are you two?
Which season and episode is this, Graham?
It's season 2, is that what we call it?
Yes, I think
it's
so.
It's definitely
yeah.
season 2. Yeah.
And that's
episode N plus 1 from the last one.
Yeah.
I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Ben Afrad.
And I'm me.
Mike's come all the way over from Germany.
It's
a little bit overcast.
This is the first time I've been in Nick's house for ages. I can't remember that Land Rover being there last time, Nick. Or maybe I didn't see it because I was too busy drinking all your beer.
Yeah, you were very busy drinking all my beer, but now that is a recent addition. I can only say, you know, if you're going to get drunk, don't go on eBay late at night with lots of gin inside you.
But it looks perfect for the zombie apocalypse. It looks parked there just for
actually,
that purpose.
I really love the Land Rover actually, because although bits of it are falling off and what have you, it's basically just a giant Meccano set. The people who designed it were quite clever. It was designed to be basically taken apart with about 3 spanners and a screwdriver, and you can take everything off it and fix it. Unfortunately, you do need to take everything off and fix it because bits of it break all the time.
So it's like a giant Meccano set that can give you tetanus as well.
So in this episode, we have the usual awesome news from Ben. We've got some discoveries. We've got some voices of the masses.
Yes, and some vocalise your neurons as well, amazingly.
One day.
I know. One day we'll get it right. So let's go.
Right, news. Let's start off with some Linux news. Why not?
Good work, man.
Well, there's not much Linux news this fortnight. Our top item is the Reddit Linux survey came in, and surprisingly, this really shocked me. Arch topped the list of the most used distros.
Really?
Yes, it knocked Ubuntu out, and I would have imagined Ubuntu losing its top spot because certain people don't like the Unity interface.
Yeah, but this is down to the people. Yeah, that's very surprising.
But
is
Arch,
that everybody kind of
Arch.
It's like people saying Gen 2 back in the day.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's wildly inaccurate in the general state of Linux because it only surveyed the people on Linux Reddit, and that's not your average Linux user.
They do heavily promote Arch on there. It tends to come up a lot in discussions. I hang out on Reddit/r. How do you say it? How do you sound cool? R Linux?
Oh. I don't know, that just sounds like you're a pirate. R Linux.
did it correlate to the browser ID for the people who were, you know, filling in? So that they were all using Ubuntu
or Internet Explorer. Yeah. I use Arch, honestly. Tap tap tap.
So all you can deduce from that really is that the people who are on Reddit like to make people believe that they're using Arch rather than anything else.
I suppose, yeah. So basically, Arch is now the coolest Linux distribution. It's one everyone pretends to use while they're using Ubuntu. Possibly, I don't know.
Here come the flames.
I must admit, I use Arch, but I've also got...
Yeah. Arch with Unity, was it, Graham?
I've got Mint installed as well, and there's been a few times that I've been trying to do something in Arch when I've just given up and rebooted to Mint.
Well, I saw this discussion as well, and some people were saying that the Arch Wiki now is so good that some people use it for documentation for other distros.
It is really, really very good.
Yeah,
mainly because it covers so much stuff in great detail. Of course, being Arch, it has to because you have to meddle with everything in great detail.
It is
really good. I find it impressive. Mm.
Do you ever have any big problems when you're doing updates? I mean, that was one of the criticisms that used to be aimed at Arch. It could break overnight.
In the old podcast, I got in trouble for saying that I made the mistake of doing Pacman-SYU and not first checking the documentation.
You didn't RTFM.
It was the whole System D debacle where, you know, I should have known that they were going to reinstall System D over the top of my system and broke it, and so couldn't boot from it and couldn't get any further advice. It was my fault.
Well, you say that. I did the pseudo apt-get upgrade and update on a LTS Ubuntu and it broke last week.
Why, Nick? Why?
It's my fault.
Actually, to be fair, it only broke X, so I could log in on the terminal.
It only broke my user interface. That's a real Linux thing to say.
Had you been using a third-party driver your graphics?
Probably. Yeah. But, actually, no, I haven't. I've only got internal Intel graphics on that computer. Okay. But anyway, I did. I did an update, and I looked at it, and I realised it was pulling repositories for a different version of Ubuntu than was installed. So I can see I've installed all sorts of PPAs and repositories. So
it does work. It does actually. I've done it on 3 machines recently, and any one of them didn't work, and that was mainly because I'd added so many different PPAs and I'd forgotten to disable them before I did the update.
Yeah, I think this was a PPA issue, to be fair.
Yeah, so there are problems updating Arch. It is something you have to keep on top of.
So always keep tabs on the website before you do the...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had any big problems like that since then, but I know I've got one machine that I haven't updated for probably 9 months that's running Arch. It's actually the arcade machine, and I'm just so reluctant to do it.
I don't
have a few hours to go back into it and see what it is I've missed. So.
Yeah.
A surprising number of people said they were running Arch on servers.
Yes, that surprised me as well. Yeah. You'd think you'd really want an LTS Debian-style CentOS distro for that, yeah.
Yeah, and what advantage do you get from running Arch on servers?
You sound cool.
Yeah, you get to go on Arch Linux.
Yeah, somebody should get running it on like the International Space Station or a nuclear submarine.
As long as they don't enable automatic updates.
It's
funny, in Arch, I haven't even bothered getting networking working from boot because I can't be bothered. So I go through all the inet commands when I boot up my machine. Which is awful. So lazy.
Actually, on my Lubuntu machine, I shall have to start the network manager manually. But only when I go onto a new network.
Yeah.
But yeah, Linux works really well for everyday usage. More news. The Chinese government has banned Windows 8.
Mm.
Ooh, bad Windows 8.
Just for its rubbish interface, or they're looking for alternatives?
I believe they might be very interested in Linux.
That's a scoop. Is that a scoop? Is there a certain version of Linux that might be interested in?
There might be.
Arch, you mean?
Obviously, because, yes. That would be cool.
What they'd need is a really good cloud stack to go along with that, I'd have thought. Managing all of that data.
Only if it came in a big red box instead of our engine.
Yeah, we're fulfilling our obligation here.
Basically, they want to get away from sort of American hegemony on the technology stack for political reasons, I assume, as much as ugly interface reasons.
That's probably not on cost, is it? Because do they buy any licenses for Windows?
It makes sense. I mean, if you're a government, you shouldn't really be entrusting all your data into what is essentially an enemy government's...
But I thought the Chinese were already onto this with, was it Red Flag Linux? Wasn't that a sort of a state-sponsored Linux distribution? And
hasn't that shut up shop now? And Red Star that shut up.
I believe so, yeah. So that it's kind of unusual. You think they'd go one way or the other and they're not sort of flailing around.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you said that.
It's a massive opportunity for Linux. Even if it's Ubuntu, it's great, you know.
Even if it's Ubuntu.
They have to dredge the bottom of the barrel.
We can't try Slackware.
Actually, having said that, Deepin's a really good distro, but it's an Ubuntu spin built by Chinese users and aimed more at the Chinese market. And they had one of the first really good software centres in Linux.
I guess, it would take some serious infrastructure, wouldn't it, to do the same thing for China? It might even become a whole Chinese kind of operation.
Yeah.
Are you moving to China, Nick?
Where is my passport?
Okay, let's move away from Linux for a moment into more general open source news. Firefox have got in trouble with the EFF for partnering with Adobe. Is it Adobe or Adobe?
I think Adobe.
Partnering with Adobe for over digital rights management, or digital restrictions management, if you want to use it.
Better name.
That terminology. It's a thorny subject, to be honest, because I can see both sides of it. Because on the one hand, DRM is likely to be around for a long time, and it's better to have something that's not Silverlight.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, DRM is horrible and doesn't really work very well.
I mean, I can understand. I was reading Mitchell Baker's blog just this morning, and she says why Mozilla has to consider accepting DRM, because they're just going to get left out of what is becoming an essential part of the internet, delivering movies and TV through the web browser. And their argument is they're just going to get left behind if they don't make deals like this.
Well, everybody will just move over to Chrome or something, and then you've got another set of problems.
But, I mean, me personally, I think it's a huge mistake. In fact, I was reading a couple of things about it. If Mozilla and Firefox has to stand for anything, I think it has to stand for an open, net neutral internet and browser standard.
But does that, they can stand there and they can wave that flag, but if they end up with no users because you can't use Netflix on it, what have they won?
But I think it's just the beginning. I think it'll get worse if Mozilla goes down this route and starts introducing DRM for these things. They'll be more into DRM for other things. I mean, the big media companies would love there to be DRM in everything, and I just think it sets that kind of precedent.
It does set a precedent, doesn't it?
But there is already DRM in so much.
And we all deal with it, I know.
Yeah, especially video. And it'd be much nicer to have an open solution to it. I mean, I'm fairly resigned to the fact that it's here. I'd much rather it wasn't. But given that it is here and it's not going to go away, I would rather I could use Firefox than not use Firefox.
But I think it'll become a bigger problem. It'll become more of an issue, and then Firefox in 5 years' time and the internet might not be all that usable when you want to switch to a different Linux distribution or you want to use the internet on something that doesn't have DRM.
But the alternative is that the internet just isn't usable on Linux. I mean,
That's how things were. And
look how bad it is.
It was Mozilla and Firefox that actually brought internet banking to the rest of us just by providing an option, an alternative, and showing that that could be a standard.
But, I mean, look how long it's been for things like Silverlight. I mean, now there's still, with Pipelight, it's not a good solution. But, I mean, we just didn't have Netflix support for a long time.
And we still haven't got Netflix support.
Well, yeah. You can make it work.
Yeah.
I wonder if there'll be a fork of Firefox because of this. I mean, there are already things like, is it Pale Moon and some other...
Well, I would imagine Ice Weasel might.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
But DRM is also wrong.
DRM is wrong.
That's the other fundamental part of this. It's a waste of time.
It just doesn't work. Yeah, I just don't understand how people think it
crippling can work. The internet and free software for this, let's pretend, but for control theater.
But this is like the is-ought paradox. You know, the fact is there is DRM, and it doesn't matter what there should be. It is here, and it is widely used.
But don't you think we have an obligation to try and make it go away?
Yes, but
and embracing it in your browser isn't really sending the right message to the...
Yes, but they don't care about Linux users. So if we,
definitely not going to care about Linux users if DRM goes into Firefox.
We could
in the end, if Linux becomes more influential, then maybe they're going to have to care about our attitude.
But Linux won't become more influential if you can't use half the internet on it.
It was things were a lot worse off 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And Linux is still making,
it's up to 1% of internet users. You know,
that's okay.
It's not, it's not bad, but you need to be able to use things that people expect to be able to use for anyone to start using Linux. And even if that is morally reprehensible, like DRM.
Perhaps interestingly, Brendan Eich, the ousted CEO, wrote a blog post called "The Bridge of Khazard Doom," a DRM. and this was only last year. I think it was like October last year. And he starts off by saying people are rightly concerned about what's going on at the W3C with DRM. And his post actually outlines why he thinks that DRM in Firefox and at Mozilla would be a huge mistake. And I think it's interesting that with Brendan out, this is perhaps one of the first signs that we see of Mozilla's softening to, you know, peer pressure or to doing things that might not idealistically be the right thing to do, which Brendan did a very good job of doing over the years.
He would have made a good voice of the masses, this, actually.
Right? Yeah. Well, it's not too late.
Yeah. Like in 2 weeks.
So that's DRM.
We could probably spend a whole hour talking about it.
Let's have a look what's next up on the news. Let's switch over to a word from our sponsors, Ubuntu. First up on the Ubuntu news is Jono Bacon, the community manager. That was his title, is it?
Yeah.
The Ubuntu community manager has left. He's moving to the XPRIZE Foundation.
Yeah. Mm. Sounds like a fantastic... Jono is a really nice guy, so I'm really pleased for him. You know, it sounds like a good... He'd done the job for 8 years, which is a long time.
Yeah.
And XPRIZE, he's doing some community management or something similar at the XPRIZE people, and they do a lot of philanthropy, is that's what it's called, I don't know. Lots of money without having to earn the money back.
Yeah, their goal is solving what they call the big problems, isn't it? They started off with the space flight and
things.
Yes, so they're mostly, I mean, some of them are more interesting projects than others, but they're all sort of generally humanitarian type goals. I'm sure he'll do a great job there.
So is this a sign that Ubuntu is taking the community less seriously?
No, it's a sign that someone got offered a really great job.
Sweet deal.
And he decided to take it. And I don't think he took the decision lightly either, because obviously he's invested a lot of time and energy into the Ubuntu community over the years as well.
And I've been told that there's still going to be a community manager.
Oh, of course they will.
They're going to hire them internally. So it sounds like they already have a good idea.
Jono also, while he was Ubuntu, trained up, if you like, a large group of people in community management type things. So yeah, there are plenty. I mean, it wasn't just him doing it on his own all that time. There are other people at Canonical who are very good at that sort of thing too. So I'm sure he will be.
Yeah, he had quite a team, didn't he? There was like 8 or 10 people on the team.
And next up, let's move over to games for a minute. Witcher 2.
So Witcher 2 is a massive game, a successful game from 2012. It's like a major PC RPG title. Was ported to OS X some time ago, and then just last week there was a Linux port announced and made available on Steam. It was for £2.99, I think, for 48 hours. So a lot of us bought it. And the credit for this kind of discovery goes to Liam Dorr, actually, of gamingonlinux.com and our games editor. It basically just uses a shell. It looks to me more like a shell around the Intel OS X port than a Wine port. But nonetheless, the performance of the Linux version is absolutely dreadful, terrible, awful, unplayable. There are reports of people getting their money back from Steam. Because even on a decent system, it doesn't run. It doesn't run on mine. I've got a pretty good graphics card. It's like an NVIDIA 570 and an Intel i5 CPU, and it ran like a dog on my machine. So it raises interesting question okay, we need ports. It's great that there are games coming to Linux, but, you know, do we really need such poor quality ports? And, you know, just to get in on the catchment. Also, it mentions Ubuntu, it also mentions SteamOS, which is becoming more prominent in the Steam community, that they don't mention Linux. You know, this is a game that runs on SteamOS and Ubuntu, which I quite like as well, if that doesn't put off people. But otherwise, I'm going to talk about it a bit later, because I've got a bit of a discovery related to trying to work around it. But yes, that's that news.
It's a bit sad, isn't it? But like you say, on the one hand, you want to support people who are doing ports of games to Linux, but obviously it helps if they make them work. I mean, they've been, I mean, not recently, but in the past, there've been so many commercial ports of games that just didn't work, and some which have been really great. And I think like Unreal Tournament was really good on
Linux. Yeah. Linux. XCOM a couple of days ago, that's getting a full Linux native port.
Oh, is it? Excellent.
Yeah. So that's something that really would get really behind, wholly behind.
I think, maybe there's some merit in waiting for people to review games before you buy them.
Yeah. Don't buy it. Yeah.
Is there any Ubuntu stuff you want to talk about here?
There's all sorts of Ubuntu stuff. I don't know. The you mentioned the Orange Box briefly, and that was a really cool project. I think more interestingly for cloud type things, if I'm allowed to talk about cloud type things, the recent OpenStack Developer Summit. It was the most fantastic demo ever.
Was that in Las Vegas?
No, that was in Atlanta. It was the HP conference was in Las Vegas. There was another fantastic demo there, which was Ubuntu running on Power 8, which is, you know, IBM's power system. The OpenStack stuff was just brilliant. It showed off the new cloud installer, which is a new tool at Canonical for installing OpenStack. And basically you run through a little screen of choices and clicking the buttons, and it goes off and machines power up and things happen, and then you have a cloud. It's really great. It was just a really cool demo, and also interesting from the point of view of in cloud terms. It's not so much OpenStack is great. It's becoming more and more popular. People want to use OpenStack, but now the focus is not just on the things you can do with OpenStack, but how you can manage OpenStack, how you can bring up OpenStack, how you can like make your cloud work the way you want it to. And I think there's going to be a lot more exciting stuff on that in the year to come.
Canonical's been part of the OpenStack from the very beginning, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
So it isn't like a new flash in the pan jump on a cloud bandwagon.
No, but on the other hand, I mean, although Canonical has been very close to OpenStack in terms of support and making sure that Ubuntu works with OpenStack and that OpenStack works on Ubuntu. Also, I mean, Canonical is very vendor neutral when it comes to clouds. All of our cloud software works across a number of different substrates, as we like to call it. So Amazon HP Cloud, which is actually OpenStack based, but also things like Joint and DigitalOcean. There are new cloud providers are being added all the time. Azure works, Juju and all the rest of the tools work on Azure, and the architectures, of course, as well. Power and AMD 64. How long have I got left?
I think I said it in the last episode. I think Canonical's really onto something with this. I think this could be the raison d'etre for Canonical. It could become a big cloud player, as it already is in the background with everybody using Ubuntu as it is. But, you know, this could make all the difference.
But could this just be a repeat of the desktop all over again, where you get loads of users but make no money?
I don't think so, no, because this is something that you've got to pay for.
But do you pay
this is
Canonical,
something you've got to pay for,
or do you pay Amazon or Microsoft, whoever's hosting it?
Probably a bit of both.
Probably, yes. I don't want to get into the financial details.
So that's the news.
So that takes us to finds of the fortnight.
Oh. What's the guy on Twitter?
Who's
monitoring us.
The guy on Twitter who scores us on all the references. To
I did well last episode.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't there.
You're already up to a half now, Graham.
Yeah. I think I made a mistake early on in the introduction as well. But finds of the finds of the fortnight. Does anyone want to go first?
Sure.
You've got one, because you didn't have one in the drive over.
That's true.
Have you found something in my house? That's cheating.
These are really good. These.
Yeah, we've discovered these Nick's...
Millionaire shortbread things.
Well, Nick said he didn't make them himself, so that's not really a discovery, is it? So,
find.
No. I'm really sorry, that guy, whose name I forget right now. But he's probably spat out his coffee in rage at us. I've found Betty.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I'm glad. We're all happy for you.
I didn't know she was missing.
I'm glad you had the sex change.
Betty is a Linux version of Siri.
Oh, yes. I remember reading about this.
Somebody actually recommended it to me and said you should put this in the Fosspick section in our magazine. So that I will do. But Betty, so Betty is like Siri, the personal assistant thing on Apple iGadgets, where you just say, oh, what's the weather like in so-and-so, or how do I get to A, B, or C, and you get a response. But of course, being Linux, there's no voice control, so you type things in.
Excellent.
So it works at the command line. So you say, Betty, what is the weather like in London? And Betty will go on the internet and query and give you a result.
Enable the I feel lucky search.
maybe connect to Apple servers. You know. Or you can say, can you translate these words into another language? Or what is the date? Or how many words are in this document? And so forth. It's still pretty early in development, so there aren't a million options you can use it with. And typing in everything by hand, sort of.
Of course, anyone who's bought a Raspberry Pi Python programming book, learning Python with the Raspberry Pi,
oh, yeah,
will have discovered how to create one where you do speak into it, into a microphone.
So you are already way better than this fine.
Well, to be honest, all I did...
Alex wrote that bit, did he?
No, I wrote that bit, I'll have you know. All I did was plug together Google's voice API with Wolfram Alpha's search API.
That sounds very cool.
It was like 50 lines, probably less, of Python. And it wasn't perfect, but you could ask it questions and whatnot.
That does sound pretty. That's better. I'll cover that in Fosspix instead. Because I presume you don't need to run it on a Raspberry Pi. It's just,
no.
Just work everywhere where you've got a microphone. So.
Yeah, it's Python, so it's probably cross-platform.
Put it up on GitHub and then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my find.
Fine. Shall I go? I've got a few finds this fortnight. Last podcast we talked about the distros we were using. I said I was using Ubuntu 12.04.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did an upgrade on that and it broke. Probably
you did things wrong.
I probably did things wrong, to be honest. There's all sorts of PPAs and repositories in there. And I sort of looked at it and I thought I could either fix this or I could just install the distro I meant to install the first time. So I did the latter thing. So I've got 14.04 now. And it's been nice to have an upgrade. I like the new version of Firefox with the 29.
With the new interface.
Yeah, it basically looks like a rethemed version of Chrome.
Yeah, that made a lot of people unhappy.
But I like it.
I liked it as well.
I think it looks better. I've got the looks of Chrome with the freedom, and I actually prefer the rendering in Firefox as well. I think it looks a bit smoother than Chrome's rendering. So I like that. I'm still getting used to the menus in the Windows thing. I think I will come to like it, but it's a bit weird the way it's sort of in the title bar at the moment.
There's going to be the option of turning that off, I think.
Well, you've got the option where you can have it in the top bar or you can have it in the title bar of the window.
Right.
So it's, I don't know how to describe it quite. So you've got the window board with a little crossy bomb. Yeah. It's in there rather than the line
right,
below
okay.
it.
So it's like, not quite the same as a normal window manager position.
Exactly. No. And, yeah. and you have to hover over the title bar to show the menus, don't you?
You don't have to hover, you don't have to wait for it, but as soon as your mouse goes there, it pops up.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, so you have to go over it. And you can, but you can still click and drag and move the window around, even when you're on a menu item, which is interesting. Yeah. When I reviewed it for issue 4
on sale today,
Linux Voice, the best magazine in the world ever.
Yeah, I think I'll come to like that, but at the moment it just seems a bit weird to me.
Weren't using Unity before, though? Weren't you using Lubuntu?
Well, I've got two. My laptop's still Lubuntu, and my desktop's Unity.
Hang on, you're not running Arch?
Sorry.
You can't go on Reddit. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I've been discovering. And my final discovery is that astronauts don't use pillows. This sounded really weird. I was like, what do they lay their heads on? And then I realised, well, they don't lay their heads anywhere. They just float. And
what the... But that means they can't have pillow fights in space. That's really sad.
Yeah. It didn't make it clear what they did use for fighting, right. If not pillow. But, yeah, basically sleep in a sort of enclosure in a sleeping bag that's just tethered to the wall and just float. And I can't decide if that would be incredibly comfortable or incredibly weird.
It'd probably be a bit like one of those immersion tanks you can get, you know, you lie in water and...
Yeah. I mean, I've been scuba diving and when you're neutrally buoyant, you just float, but I've never thought I could just fall asleep here.
It might take some time, yeah.
Would probably take a bit of getting used to.
Yeah.
Wonder if you have dreams about floating when you're asleep, floating.
Or falling, because you're not... Yeah. You don't feel supported.
Because microgravity, you are really falling.
Yeah.
What websites were you looking at to find this? Fact of the day.
I was going retro. I had a bound paper thing in my hand. We used to call them books.
That sounds weird to me. I don't like this.
That's from Chris Hadfield's book. I will probably write a review of it in Linux Voice at some point.
Excellent.
I think they've got it easy anyway. In the old days, they didn't have beds. Sleeping bags and things.
Well, I did also discover they have no way of washing their clothes, so they just wear them until they fall apart, then chuck them out the window, I think. No, the Russian supply ships that come up, but they don't land, they just burn up in the atmosphere, so they put them in there.
Well, that's terrible for the environment, just throwing all their trash towards this planet. They can go and get another planet.
Considering how much fuel they use to burn up getting them, I don't think it makes much difference.
I read a while back that Tabasco sauce is incredibly popular on the International Space Station because apparently you lose your sense of taste, or, you know, depletes it.
What happens is, because there's no gravity, your snot doesn't come out. Your snot just builds up in your nose, your mucus.
So everybody's got a blocked nose in space.
Apparently it's not like blocks, but it's sort of, it's a bit coldy and it doesn't run.
Wouldn't Vicks vapor rub be more effective in space?
They'll just make it even worse, and there'll just be even more piling up in your sinuses until
it exploded. Yeah. Well, maybe that's how they fight in space.
when they can't do any clothes washing, it's probably not best. He did say that the spicy food is the most favoured.
Right.
Because, you've got so little... I would imagine it's quite similar to, on planes, your sense of taste decreases.
I've never really noticed that. That's usually because plane food is pretty bad anyway. So.
Mm. And I think that's one of the reasons it tastes bad, because you taste slightly differently. And that it's because of the dryness of the air, I believe. It dries everything up and it stops you tasting properly.
Somebody should open a restaurant where they serve plane food, but on the ground, and then you can like compare it to your experience in the air.
Well, Heston did one of his things where he was trying to, I think it was BA or one of the things, Heston Blumenthal, an insane cook. And what he recommended doing was... taking what he called a nasal douche. Basically just squirting a load of water up your nose. While you're on a flight, just before you eat. And apparently that makes it all taste better. Or amplifies the bad taste. I don't know.
I look forward to explaining getting that through security.
This is my nasal douche.
As long as it's less than 100 mil.
Cool.
And those are my finds this fortnight.
Good work.
Thanks, Ben.
I have some finds.
Awesome.
My first find is this.
Is that a small Ethernet cable?
It is a very small Ethernet
cable. Is it a crossover cable? Or?
No, it's just a straightforward Cat5 cable. For those of you listening in black and white, It's a nice purple colour. I go through a ridiculous amount of cables, not because I break things, but because I keep acquiring new things that I need to plug in. I always prefer... I don't know, I just trust wires more than more than Wi-Fi. And so I've got a huge selection of switches and routers and things upstairs in the network cave. And it's really annoying because most of my cables I've acquired over the years are like a meter or 2 meters long. And when the boxes are sat right next to each other, you don't want a 2 meter long cable. It becomes a problem. And I used to make my own, but I keep losing the little tools that you need to crimp the ends into the connectors. And I was just searching for some new cables one day, and I was trying to find the shortest one I could get. And the shortest one I can get is 0.25 meters, 25 centimeters, which is just right for connecting two boxes which are right next door to each other.
Yeah. But did you get that sent all the way from Hong Kong?
This didn't come from Hong Kong. This came from a UK company called Fruity Cables.
hence the purple color. Yeah.
Yes, it's perhaps an unfortunate choice of name because they have all sorts of different colours and all sorts of different lengths, and I just find it really useful. I can't tell you how much or how long I've been waiting to find something this appropriate.
That might be a good challenge for our listeners. If anybody knows of a cable supplier that's shorter than 0.25 metres, then
yes,
let us know.
Can you get retractable Ethernet cables? Can you get the USB ones that sort of go in and out?
Yeah, I have seen those, but I don't trust them because, in my experience of the retractable USB ones, because there are moving parts, they always fray in different places and then they break. You wouldn't need to retract that. That's just
But if you have things that were like 30 centimeters apart, and you're like, damn you, world!
You buy a 30 centimeter. I think they do a huge range of sizes. I think I've got some 50 centimeter ones as well, which are appropriate.
That reminds me when Pimeroni, who were interviewed, a small kind of gadget company in the UK based in Sheffield, and we visited them late last month for the interview in issue 4. They had these fantastic universal USB cables. They gave Ben and I one, and it's basically a small embedded hub within the cable, but it had every possible USB connector on it, and it's just a single cable.
Does it have the new USB C?
No, it doesn't. The most useful USB cable there. There was talk on the Linux Voice IRC channel this morning, actually, that those are USB connectors. How I've actually got one into an RJ45 plug, you know, mistakenly prodding them. Right. You know, they fit so snugly into all kinds of things. But anyway, yeah, that seemed like a really good cable. Shall I talk about my discovery then?
Find.
Oh.
Well, this is related to Witcher 2 running so awfully. I do have Windows 8 installed on my machine. And I never, ever use it.
Is it a legal version?
It is a legal version, yeah. And I update... So this is related to Steam. Had an update last week where you can now do in-home streaming. So in front of the television, I've got a really low-powered Linux box. It used to be the Myth TV box. It's got a passively cooled NVIDIA card. It's like a 5200 or something like that, and a 1.6 gigahertz CPU. Nothing for you can't play games on it. But in theory, I thought I could run Witcher 2 on the Windows machine upstairs and stream it to SteamOS, which I do have installed now on the old box. But to do that, I decided to update Windows 8.1. And so, firstly, my discovery is that I apologise for all the bad things I've said about Unity, because in comparison, Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 are just the greatest aberration in user interface design I've ever come across. It's so bad, I'm not... You choose shut down in the bottom left-hand part of the window. When you were using in desktop mode, you then have to scroll all the way up to the top right. I've got a 27-inch screen. There's so many... It's just awful.
You're supposed to press it, Graham. It's one hand for each.
I can... So you, in 8.1, you can revert back to the desktop mode, and it looks pretty much like Windows 7, which is fine. I can get along with it. It is Windows. But if you've still got any of the full screen apps installed, unless you manually remove them, they pop up and take over, and you have to do some weird corner clicking to get back to previous desktops. It's horrible, horrible, horrible. But anyway, I installed Steam, downloaded Witcher 2, which is 17 gigabytes. It took most of Saturday.
There are 17 gigabyte games. I know I'm an old phobia in this sense. Yeah.
How many floppy disks is that?
Yeah, man.
It's a good game, and I updated SteamOS on the machine and the television, and I've got Duvelo wireless and wired LAN, you know, through the power cable. And so I guess the machine's doing a lot. 1080p, it couldn't quite manage it with smooth gameplay. But at 720p, so that's 1280 by 720, I was able to stream the game from my modest PC upstairs and play it with a games controller plugged into my Linux box in front of the TV brilliantly. Everything worked. Sound, the controller. And it's worth saying the controller doesn't work on the native Linux version.
That's strange.
So I could use, I've got a PS3 controller I plugged into the Linux box. Stream, when you load up, if Steam is running on the Windows box and SteamOS is, or Steam is running on the Linux box, it finds your library automatically running on the Windows machine. You can launch Witcher. Witcher is a bit of a pain, in fact, because it comes up with its own manual launcher, so you need a mouse to be able to click on launch from that. But there may be a way of getting rid of that with a registry setting or something. But other than that, it works brilliantly. I can see it as a great solution to Windows games that might never get a Linux port. So if you have got Witcher and you don't want to get the money back, it might be worth doing that. That's my discovery.
So which computer does the graphics processing? Windows
machine? It's all done on the Windows machine.
So it's almost like a VNC type streaming?
Yeah, but I mean, Witcher, I don't think is a very... I didn't really notice any latency.
Yeah.
It's a good game for that, because it's a really great role-playing game, third person, you look down through the trees, but it's very graphically intensive.
Yeah.
Looks really good. And 1080p kind of worked. I don't know whether it's the task of the NVIDIA card, I presume, creating an H.264 stream while at the same time dealing with all of the 3D, yeah, or whether, you know, just the actual connection was the bottleneck, but it worked very, very well. And as this is the first time this release has gone into Steam and SteamOS, I could see it becoming a great solution. And you can do it while you're playing upstairs. You can go downstairs, turn on the SteamOS box and carry on playing.
Okay.
And you do it from a laptop as well, so it's a great way of just being able to carry on playing a game from Steam. And that's my discovery.
Find.
This is a bad one.
Andrew would now normally say that this is the halfway reminder, wouldn't he?
Yes. What is it?
Probably gone on for far too long. And so still to come
is
Vocalize Your Neurons.
Exactly.
And Voice of the Masses.
The internet famous Voice of the Masses. I've had two neurons that have been electronically transmitted to me this episode. The first is from Ricardo in Brazil. He says, I was thinking the other day about the whole topic of let's stop using Facebook and Google because they track us. Nowadays, at least here in Brazil, people are making fewer phone calls to set up get-togethers, parties and meetings. Sending WhatsApp messages or Facebook messages are becoming standard procedure. With that in mind, abdicating from Facebook would be abdicating from your social life to a certain stretch. And do we want to become antisocial people? Being tracked is definitely not a good thing, but I think losing contact with friends and acquaintances has a more direct and immediate impact on daily life. Even though that's not particularly Linux related, I think he makes a point that I see often on the internet, and especially on places like Slashdot and Reddit, people saying, oh, well, just quit Facebook. Facebook is rubbish. Just get off it, sign off. And it's not that easy for some people. I do use Facebook. Admittedly, I don't like Facebook.
I think it depends on the quality of your friends. I don't have any good friends, so I don't use Facebook.
Oh, that's a
shame. You win, Graham.
Maybe that's why all these Slash dollars can say that. But yeah, it's not that easy. Even I've had that. People say to me, oh, just quit it. Just why are you sucking up to Mark Zuckerberg? But so many of my friends and contacts in Munich are on Facebook. And if I could easily say to them, oh, well, just email me when you're planning something. But then you do get out of the loop. So
that's interesting. I do have a Facebook account. I don't use it so much anymore. It used to be good for various things, like you say, social things like finding out about events and things like that. But I think actually I'm going to be eventually forced off it, because not from my end, but from Facebook's end. Because basically most of the time I use it on my my Android tablet, and there's a pending update that I've refused to install for about a year, mainly because their app changed the permissions and it wants to know basically everything about your device, where you what contacts you have, any phone numbers, and basically absolutely everything. And I thought, well, I don't really want Facebook to know all of that and track all of that stuff. What other applications are running? That was my favorite one. Well, why does it need to know what applications I'm running? So I've refused to update it, and I assume that eventually in the distant future, or maybe not too distant future, that it'll simply stop working. It is annoying already, because every time I open it up, it reminds me that I am running a really out-of-date version, and eventually one day it'll just stop.
Yeah, I stopped using their mobile app when it just turned on GPS every time I opened it. I'm like, well, hang on a minute.
Yeah, I've said no to that.
So I just use the web app now, even on my mobile. But yeah, it does make a point. And the problem is with all these things, there isn't a good alternative that doesn't track you.
Pump.io looks pretty good, but again, when nobody's on it,
it's a chicken and egg scenario.
Completely, yeah.
Do you think there is a way? I mean, because obviously, you know, the reason Facebook does all that is to monetize their investment in creating their infrastructure and what have you. Because they've got all that money, they can hire lots of great developers and presumably do some useful things on Facebook as well, isn't it? Not really sure. Do we think it's actually really viable for someone to like create a non-intrusive, open sourcey maybe?
Well, there was Diaspora, wasn't there? Which, that in the end had quite a lot of investment and had a lot of community enthusiasm for it, a bit like Identica before Pump.io. But it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't. There's a tipping point in people. I don't know. There's so many youngsters using Facebook or moving on to WhatsApp or Snapchat or whatever they're doing. They don't care so much about their privacy, and it's that kind of sets the foundation for what we all end up using.
Yeah, I mean, the problem, I assume, it would be the cost of hosting it all more than the cost of development. I mean, if you're talking, you know, 2 billion users on Facebook.
Something crazy.
The investment in hardware that you need to run that is phenomenal.
Unless you had an automatically scaling.
and if the platform becomes that successful that you're worrying about how you're going to pay for the infrastructure, then there's going to be ways you can monetize that.
Yeah, I mean, the Diaspora was federated, I believe, which is a nice solution to it, which is basically what email is.
Yeah.
But
I think Facebook, the thing that will kill Facebook eventually will be Facebook itself. I know I read that they're planning to introduce auto-playing video ads in the UK. With the sound off, but you know, eventually that'll become with the sound on. And I think it's because there's this constant pressure to make more money from the users. They can't just sit there and say, hey, this is working well as a business, we're making money. The shareholders want more money, so they constantly, their only strategy is to put more and more advertising in, because nobody's going to say, well, that's enough, you know, we're already quite rich. There's that pressure.
Yeah, so maybe paying for it is the answer.
Maybe paying for it is the answer.
Yeah. I think Facebook is past its peak. I think it's falling now. It's not cool. The youngsters now are all WhatsApping and Snapchatting. It's, you know, a lot of people my generation that we really grew up with it, but really got into it when it first came out in their sort of mid-20s, barely use it anymore.
And apparently a lot of younger people are using other services because their parents are on Facebook, and they don't want their parents to see what they're doing. So. Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing that makes me want to go back to it other than, yeah, communicate with people whose email addresses I don't have.
Mm.
And it's just not cool anymore.
I'll move on to the second neuron I was sent from Ian McAloon. He says, there's been a fair bit of discussion around the demise of Windows XP providing an opportunity for Linux to reach a new audience. Next week, I'll be taking my father-in-law through the process of migrating his laptop from XP to an as-yet unspecified Linux distribution at his request. Initially, this will be dual boot to ease him into it, and then once he's comfortable with Linux, XP will go. I'm a long-time Ubuntu user since 8.10, but rather than just impose Ubuntu on him, I've armed myself with a bootable USB stick with Puppy, Magea, Lubuntu, OpenSUSE with GNOME 3, and Ubuntu 14.04. I've also got the Mint cover disk from Linux Voice. I've really enjoyed checking out what these distros have to offer. I confess to my surprise that I found the GNOME 3 desktop of OpenSUSE is really attractive. I could be tempted to switch. And it occurs to me that this is also a great opportunity for existing Linux users to take a break from their favorite distro and get to know some of the other great distros that are available. Then they will be in a great position to guide former XP users to a distro that really suits them. I probably wouldn't have done this if I hadn't been asked to help out my father-in-law, so even I've benefited from the end of XP, and I don't use it. As his laptop is a bit gutless, I'm hoping he'll opt for Lubuntu, then I can use the Linux Voice feature on customizing the LXDE desktop to introduce him to the UK's number one Linux magazine. Double win. Thanks, Ian. Yeah, that's quite an interesting point as well. There've probably been a lot of people who just sticking with their distro for a while and suddenly need to convert people from XP and have actually gone distro hopping and distro shopping.
Maybe we should have a day for that. You know, like, you know, a distro day. Try a distro other than your default distro.
Or distro swap. You know, like those swap programs on TV where people swap houses and wives and. Thanks, guys. If anybody else wants to vocalise their neurons, drop me a line, mike@linuxvoice.com. Which brings us on to the section that Andrew would normally do, but he's... where is he, anyway?
He's in York.
Oh, he's up in York, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
It's a four-hour drive.
We won't impose that on him. He's too busy fixing typos in my work, probably, so... Yes, this... episode's voice of the masses. The question we put to the internet is, what killer app is Linux missing? Asking, is there a piece of proprietary software that's not been ported to Linux, or is there a whole bunch of software? Should we be focusing on free software alternatives instead of asking companies to port programs? And we've had, as of this second, 49 responses, so it's been a popular topic. Bobby J. Moss, good old Bob Moss, kicked things off with saying Civilization 5. But hasn't that actually now got a Linux port?
There will be. It's going to come out.
Right, yeah.
It? Yeah.
He said also Elite Dangerous.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, because that's going to be ported to OS 10. But if David Braben can write 260,000 lines of assembly language, which is why he's my personal programming god, then he should be able to port Elite Dangerous to Linux.
That's another reason to keep the Windows 8 partition kicking around.
Surely assembly language is just assembly language.
Yeah, exactly. Who needs anything else? Ignacio de la Derel says Photoshop, Rhinoceros, a CAD app, and Unity 3D. Photoshop came
Unity
up a few
3D
times.
Does
I thought that is on there. Yeah.
It's in the process of being ported, isn't it?
It is in the process of being ported, but it is coming.
Yeah.
Same with the Unreal Engine 4, which is the first demos running on Linux have only just come out.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. Davey P says he needs a drop-in replacement for Visio. I've never found a Linux app capable of making process maps and flowcharts as quickly and easily.
So tempting to say it's okay, just keep Windows for that.
Yeah, games come up quite a lot. Brian Hunter talks about games. Stefano talks about other games as well. Jim mentions Adobe InDesign. He says Scribus is okay, but not quite good enough for pro DTP.
Depends what sort of DTP you do. There are still some issues with it. However, I have to say the PDF export from Scribus is pretty much better than any of the Adobe software.
Really?
Yeah, it's more... Well, I mean, as of the last time I used it, which wasn't that long ago, it's more compliant with the actual standard than the Adobe version is, which is a bit surprising. But
didn't Adobe create the PDF standard in the first place?
They did. But history has taught us that the people who create things are usually the worst ones at following their own rules.
True.
Maybe we should look at it again. It's just finding the time to do something like that. I do remember, in fact, I talked about this recently. I was on the UK Ubuntu podcast last week or the week before. And one of the questions was, why do we use InDesign to create the magazine? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is really, Stacey only knows InDesign, and it's something that we all know. And we're printing 20,000 copies on a Saturday morning. We just have to have the confidence in knowing what we're doing. But there's no reason why we can't try and use Inkscape and Scrivus, you know, in 6 months or 12 months' time. And you, I mentioned that you tried it at the Next Format several years ago.
Mm. Issue 96 or something like that, I seem to remember. And it worked. I mean, it was. I seem to remember there were a lot of very frightened people, including me, to be honest. Because although, as far as I could tell, it was going to work, the real test of whether it would actually work or not was when we got the magazine. Flick forward.
Yeah, 2 weeks after all the subscribers had got there.
Are there any actually words?
Would there be anything to stop us using it for some pages, but as we started it?
I'm not sure what your print process is, but if you provide PDFs to the printer, then you can. The major issue I seem to remember from 96 was nothing to do with Scrivus at all. It was to do with the font.
Mm. Right. And we shouldn't have that issue.
You shouldn't have that issue because someone very clever told you to choose a proper font. So it should be. I mean, yeah, that's something. Maybe I can help you with that. you could certainly do something like a spread or something in Scrivus and see how it goes.
I'll try designing it.
We should see how it goes.
Yeah. Condi says, I would really like to have a reliable voice recognition application like Dragon Dictate. I don't know of any voice recognition.
There aren't any good ones. There are some. None of them just work out the box.
I remember Nick used to try them because he used to be quite interested in this.
Because of my dodgy elbow.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah, I remember, yeah.
None of them are any good. Yeah. There's the Dragon one, and there was an IBM one as well. I'm not sure if that's still available.
Mm.
They had an engine for it, which they did work, but they required a lot of tinkering with.
Mm.
And I suppose it depends what you want. I mean, I was trying to get something to learn how I wanted to write Python code, which is like basically impossible.
Tab.
So your mileage may vary on those things.
I wonder if Google has an API.
Well, they do. Like, you've used it, haven't you?
You can upload through their web API. It's not supposed to work. You've got to sort of, I forget exactly what you've got to do. I think you've got to set their HTTP headers to tell you're using Chrome or something like that. But it's not difficult to do. But you can only do 15 seconds at a time.
I noticed that Chrome now has Google Now embedded with it, so you can say, OK, Google.
Mm. Who says, honestly, the one thing I miss in Linux is an equivalent of Microsoft's OneNote. It's a very good program. The closest Linux analog I found is Basket, and it doesn't really compare. I don't know anything about OneNote, but I have seen a lot of people talk about it and say that it's actually a pretty good program from Microsoft, although it's proprietary. So
what is it?
What's it do?
Some note-taking program. But
I really like Google Keep. For notes and things like that. I don't know whether it's as comprehensive as that, but
does that have a Linux version or is it a web app?
It's just a web app, yeah.
So now Google knows what's on your shopping list as well.
Yeah. Google already knows everything.
So. On your shopping list and a Google Doc, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. grocery budget. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a tutorial last month.
Jan wins this voice of the masses by saying what we need is a foolproof Windows to Linux conversion utility. It analyzes the Windows partition to create an equivalent using Linux. It also installs the open source equivalent for each program installed on the Windows partition. And this got me thinking, it's a brilliant idea. There are some Linux distributions that when you install them alongside Windows, they try and import some settings, don't they, from like your Windows browser. Ubuntu does that, I think. Yeah, it's been ages since I've
Ubuntu just lost my Windows thing on Grub.
It's doing you a favour.
Yeah.
But what a great idea this is. And obviously you could take it further.
Yeah, yeah.
It finds out what theme you're using and creates a similar theme. So
yeah, same desktop background.
Same desktop.
If you've got Windows installed at the same time, it would be fine.
Exactly, so it reads as much as possible.
Same blue screen of death.
only joking.
But yeah, it could populate a menu. Say you're booting alongside Windows 7, it looks at your start menu and it creates a similar structure with programs in the same place, and so with their names, LibreOffice, but then it could say in brackets next to it, like Word, or something like that.
Yeah.
Put things in similar places, import various settings for programs, and so it's pretty much a Windows to Linux conversion kit instead of, oh, we've detected a couple of things, but here's your brand new operating system. It would take quite a bit of work to do.
Yeah.
I'd actually really like to have a go at doing it myself, but I seem to spend all my time working on this magazine and sitting in beer gardens, so... yeah, but I think Jan is absolutely right. That would be the killer application, a seamless Linux distribution that picks up all these things. You just pop it in. There's your dual boot system. Enjoy Linux. Get used to it.
Could then gradually merge over to another desktop. So after about 3 years, it slowly turns into GNOME 3.
And you wake up one morning, what? Where did I go? What else have we got here?
Some excellent suggestions.
There have been some very, very good suggestions. And I think a lot of companies should look at threads like this and see.
Until recently, mine might have been something like Ableton Live, but with Bitwig Studio coming to Linux, even though it's expensive, that pretty much fulfills that role.
I can't think of anything I want, actually, because I do pretty much all my computing on Linux. So.
I recently purchased my first ever Windows license, and that was for InDesign.
I would still like, I know I mentioned this before and people are probably bored of me mentioning, but I would really like a 3D tool that wasn't Blender. There are some, 3D is difficult and some tools are better for some things than others, and maybe it's just because I got so used to it on the Amiga, but Lightwave was always the one that I found easiest to use, easiest to visualize what I was doing stuff in, if it was for like an animation or something like that, because it was set up and used the same sort of idioms of, you had a camera that you moved around, and I know Blender does that as well, but it's just not quite the same or as easy. There are probably more important things to put.
Didn't Blender tweak its interface a while back? Didn't it have a bit of redesign? I've never really used Blender much.
Don't you just use it with Python?
Well, yes. But it depends what you're doing. If you want to, if you're doing solid modeling or something like that, then yeah, you can script it quite easily with Python. There are some good libraries for doing that without using Blender in Python. But I was thinking more for the animation things. I guess you could do that with Python as well, but it just seems easier to sort of point the camera at the thing you want.
Yeah. I mean, with Blender, it's one of those... They can make a cut-down version of Blender, because the problem is that you can make it look like Lightwave, but there's just so many different options everywhere. Each one of those panels, each time you split the screen, it's this same functionality for every single time.
I know that it is really good, and I know that you can do great things in it, obviously. But I find, like, even following tutorials and things online, they're always... Well, most of the ones I find, like, things have moved, or, that option isn't in that menu anymore, it's somewhere else, and it becomes impossible.
Do you remember the magazine dropping animation from the Indiegogo campaign?
That Nick made?
Well, the person that did that told me that it took ages and ages, and just to get the physics to work correctly. There's a load of outtakes, actually, that he showed me of the magazine doing all kinds of different things. I should put them on YouTube, just to try and get the physics right for the thing dropping. And that's about the most simple animation you could create.
That would have been quite easy in Python.
Yeah.
Should have done it in OpenGL rather than Blender. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, everybody, for your awesome responses to that Voice of the Masses. And on that bombshell, as Alan Partridge would say, I think we've come to the end of this.
Yeah, it's already been an epic podcast there.
So your words at the beginning of this podcast were, let's keep it a short one. And
those are always his words.
I know, I feel really bad because we're taking up Nick's time and things sound like they're very busy at Canonical.
Maybe it's reverse psychology. Next time say, let's make this a really long podcast and it'll be 25 minutes.
I've also got to edit it, which takes, you know, however long times three that we edited it.
Yeah, because we actually go off topic a lot more.
I don't think I've sworn anything.
No, no, you've been well behaved this time, so... Yeah, I guess that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you again in 2 weeks and we will try to say find more, not discoveries. Sorry about that. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.